A sea of salt water is probably hidden inside one of Saturn's icy moons. That's according to some new findings from a spacecraft in orbit around Saturn. If scientists are right, this moon might be a watery oasis that could potentially support life. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce has more.
The moon is called Enceladus. It's small, only around 300 miles across, and covered with ice. A few years ago, scientists discovered that jets of water vapor and tiny ice particles were bursting out of its surface like giant geysers. These supersonic plumes stream out into space and form Saturn's outermost ring. Frank Postberg is a scientist at the Max Planck Institute for Nuclear Physics in Germany. He says if you landed a spaceship on Enceladus and got out to look at the plumes, you probably wouldn't see them unless the sun was shining the right way.
You only see them when you have the sun in front of you. Then you see the spray and probably have even a rainbow.
No spacecraft has landed there yet, but NASA's Cassini probe is orbiting Saturn and has repeatedly passed through its outermost ring. So Postberg and his colleagues have been using an onboard instrument to study tiny ice grains in that ring that originally came from Enceladus. A report in the journal Nature describes what they found.
The most important thing we found is that lots of the grains we identified actually consist of frozen salt water. It's saltwater ice.
Postberg says that strongly suggests that this frigid moon has a source of liquid water, not just ice. Salt compounds are normally found in rock. To get them out of rock, you need liquid water. Now, ever since the plumes of Enceladus were first discovered, researchers have been trying to explain them. John Spencer studies the moons of the outer planets at the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado. He says some people have argued for mechanisms that didn't require liquid water.
Now it's a lot harder to do that, and we're really being forced into, yes, there's liquid water there, and yes, it could be a potential habitat for life, I mean, if a lot of other things went right.
He says it's not clear what the likelihood is that life could be there. Still, this little moon is starting to seem downright homey. Linda Spilker is deputy project scientist for the Cassini mission at NASA.
You know, you've got liquid water. It's an alkaline solution that's also favorable for life. You've got other carbon-based compounds and the right building blocks that you would have in there that could be precursors for life.
Assuming that liquid water is there, it would have to be deep down inside the moon. That's according to Nick Schneider. He's a researcher at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He and his colleagues have been using telescopes to study the vapor coming out of Enceladus, rather than the tiny ice grains.
Because we don't see, I guess what you'd say, vaporized salt water in a big ring around Saturn, because we don't see the sodium component of that, we don't think it's salt water erupting from right near the surface.
Schneider says there could be a saltwater ocean far below the surface, one that's slowly evaporating into underground chambers that give rise to the plumes.
So that's possible, that there might be some misty caverns underneath the icy crust of Enceladus, and a little bit of salty droplets are coming out, and a whole lot of salt-free gas is coming out.
Scientists hope to learn more in November. The Cassini probe will fly by Enceladus and will get closer to the plumes than ever before, just 60 miles above the surface of this alien moon. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
If the House of Representatives does what President Obama wants it to do, it will pass a law this week that would be a milestone in efforts to restrict greenhouse gases. The president yesterday spoke of the pending legislation as an opportunity to develop new energy technologies.
The nation that leads in the creation of a clean energy economy will be the nation that leads the 21st century's global economy. That's what this legislation seeks to achieve. It's a bill that will open the door to a better future for this nation, and that's why I urge members of Congress to come together and pass it.
The idea that global warming is more attractive and saleable as an economic opportunity is an approach that's been championed by a tiny think tank in Oakland, California. NPR's Richard Harris paid a visit and spoke with the group's founders.
The Breakthrough Institute doesn't look like much, just a few offices and a shared suite in downtown Oakland. There are only 5 people on staff, and on a recent day, they were outnumbered by an incoming crop of 7 freshly minted college graduates who showed up for their summer internships.
Hey, guys, come on in.
Should we just sit? Are you going to stand right here?
Yeah, we'll stand.
Michael Schellenberger and Ted Nordhaus founded the Breakthrough Institute in 2002. Schellenberger's 37 with a fashionable buzz cut. Nordhaus is 43 and so casual he hasn't even bothered to shave. Both wear jeans and loose shirts.
Welcome. All right, so I'm going to start. And really, this is... this is your introduction to downtown
Oakland.
Once the sirens subside, Schellenberger and Nordhaus take a few minutes to lay out the philosophy of their think tank, in particular, their approach to climate change. Schellenberger tells the interns that environmental groups, like the ones he used to work for, are going about it all wrong. By urging Congress to cast carbon dioxide as a pollutant that needs to be controlled, they will constantly swim against the tide of public opinion.
We're stuck in this kind of poor paradigm for dealing with climate change, this pollution paradigm, not because environmentalists are failures, but actually because they were so successful. The Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the cap and trade on acid rain, these things worked really well.
But reducing carbon dioxide is a different story. It's not just a nuisance byproduct, it's unavoidable when we burn coal, oil, and natural gas. So getting rid of it means either capturing it or regulating it into oblivion. In theory, regulation will force companies to develop cleaner alternatives as the price of carbon pollution grows. But Schellenberger says that'll never work.
When was the last time human beings modernized our energy sources by making older power sources more expensive? And of course, by now, you probably know that the answer is never.
Likewise, personal computers didn't take off because there was a tax on typewriters, he says. And the internet didn't sprout up because the government made telegraphs more expensive.
So is there a better way to do this? Well, we think that there is. It's very simple. It's that we need to make clean energy cheap worldwide.
China will never stop burning its massive reserves of coal unless there's something cheap to replace them, he argues. And we aren't likely to stop burning coal either. Schellenberger and Nordhaus argue that the best way to develop these clean technologies is to increase federal energy research tenfold and to create a project akin to the Apollo mission to the moon. Schellenberger acknowledges that a massive increase in federal energy spending is not a popular idea at the moment.
There's this idea that the government shouldn't be involved in technology, the government shouldn't be picking winners and losers, which is sort of a funny thing to say. It's kind of like, well, why not? And when hasn't the United States government been involved in picking technology winners and losers?
He points to the computer industry as just one example of something that came into being because of deliberate federal investments. After the introductory meeting breaks up, Schellenberger and Nordhaus settle into a brown naugahyde couch in Ted's office to tell their story. They met as young adults, trying to save redwood trees on the California coast. Working as pollsters and strategists, they spent a lot of time figuring out what motivates people. That led them to rethink how to frame global warming as an issue.
The things that will drive or not drive action have nothing to do with how well you understand how fast the polar ice caps are melting.
Nordhaus says a sense of doom or shame only motivates a small segment of the public and puts off the rest. Instead, Schellenberger says their research shows that people are motivated when the issue is presented as an opportunity to revolutionize energy technology.
In fact, not only is it popular, but actually voters get excited about it. If you go and talk to folks in the Rust Belt in Ohio, or you talk to people in Silicon Valley, or you talk to people in New York, I mean, Americans love that, and they love it for, I think, reasons that are really specific to the national character, which is that that's what Americans do. We invent stuff. That is so much part of who we are, and it just seems kind of crazy that we wouldn't put that at the center of our policy agenda.
The downside of this, of course, is that global warming is a potential crisis, and critics say the solution offers no timetable for action and no assurances that technologies will be ready before the world tips into a dangerous new state. so they often hear that their approach is a distraction.
Well, I say, you know, look in the mirror here.
Nordhaus says the pollution paradigm isn't succeeding either. Most countries aren't keeping the lofty promises they made in international climate talks, and the 1,200-page climate legislation now before Congress is so full of escape clauses and giveaways, it's not clear exactly what it will achieve. One thing it won't do is dramatically increase federal research dollars. As a result, Nordhaus and Schellenberger rail against the bill in the blogosphere, and they're trying to get attention on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, I'm taking off.
Good luck in D.C.
Hey, thanks, yeah.
A few days after our interview, we meet up again in front of the Dirksen Senate office building.
Hey, Richard.
Greetings. Hi.
Long time no see.
Indeed. We actually have coats and ties, huh?
I know. You got us on, like, maybe the 2 days a year I will put a tie on.
Schellenberger and Nordhaus came to town with a simple plea. The government needs to spend more money, not less, in developing radical new energy technologies and helping bring those to market. Today, they're accompanied by Peter Teague from the left-leaning Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Breakthrough Institute's main funder. Teague is pleased with what Schellenberger and Nordhaus have achieved to date.
The president has adopted their language, their message, the story that they helped to develop. The next stage is for the actual reality of the policy to reflect the glowing, wonderful, positive, visionary rhetoric.
Turning President Obama's rhetoric on energy opportunity into a fundamentally new approach to climate change will require a massive political shift. And that's the breakthrough that the Breakthrough Institute is hoping to achieve. Richard Harris, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. 40 years ago today, a spark flew from a train crossing a low bridge over the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland. That spark ignited oil-soaked debris in the water. The river burned, and that fire helped to ignite the environmental movement.
Burn on, big river, burn on.
Randy Newman wrote the song Burn On, and the environmental movement found a new symbol. 40 years later, the Cuyahoga is a very different river. It teems with fish and wildlife. Dan Bobkoff of member station WCPN in Cleveland explains what happened.
Even today, tell someone you live in Cleveland, and invariably you'll hear, doesn't your river catch on fire? Never mind that in the middle of the 20th century, rivers and industrial cities across the country caught on fire all the time. Never mind it's been 4 decades since the Cuyahoga's infamous blaze that only lasted about a half hour. That image of a sludge and oil-filled river on fire persists. But today's river could not be more different.
You guys ready?
To see how different, some workers with the Northeast Ohio Regional Sewer District are shocking fish today. From July to October, John Rhodes and his crew take this boat out and lower electrical poles into the water to briefly stun, net, and then release the fish.
We can sort of see the fish bubbling up to the top there.
Yeah, that was a fish that was in the field, so it was attracted. It was coming up. And I didn't see any smallmouth bass, and they're mostly our bass species.
What they're finding today are dozens of kinds of fish, from red horses to steelhead. And another good sign, many of the fish they find hate pollution. In the early 1980s, when they started keeping track, parts of this river were so polluted that virtually nothing could survive. Many of these same sections are now rated as exceptional for fish habitat. Some parts of the river near Akron still have problems with sewage and runoff, but in much of the Cuyahoga, beavers, herons, and even bald eagles thrive. It's a remarkable transformation.
It was an open septic tank with junk floating on top.
Frank Samsel spent years cleaning up the river on his boat he called the Putzfrau, which is German for cleaning lady.
Anything you can imagine that can float or could is soluble was in the river.
So how did the Cuyahoga go from a lifeless, opaque river of sludge to water that, while far from pristine, is the cleanest it's been since the Industrial Revolution.
I think it was 90-some percent news media that did it.
Specifically, Time magazine. The fire initially generated barely a mention in the news. But a few weeks later, Time was getting on the burgeoning environmental bandwagon and published an article that mentioned the fire. Some river, the magazine mockingly wrote. Oh, and a lot of people read that issue. It was the same one with news of Ted Kennedy's Chappaquiddick incident and the first moon landing. So while that may have been unfair to Cleveland, the story about the burning Cuyahoga became an environmental rallying cry, one that led to the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency and eventually the Clean Water Act. Trains still cross the Cuyahoga today at the site of the fire. The debris under the bridge is now natural, logs and such. My guide is Keith Lynn, who studies water quality at the sewer district.
There's so much history here. I mean, this spot was the impetus for so much change in this country, and yet there's no plaque, there's no anything that would tell you that.
You're right. This is a rather historic location.
But further up the river in Akron, there's another big change. The public is beginning to see this river as a destination.
We get about halfway there. We'll start working over to the right.
Mike Larkin and some kayaking buddies are about to take their boats on some of the river's rapids. He says the reputation hasn't quite caught up with the reality.
We get a funny look when they say we actually get in that river and kayak it.
But today, on this 40th anniversary of the fire that led to this dramatic cleanup, the city held a concert on its banks, declaring the river reborn. The EPA, that was in large part formed out of the fire, now declares parts of the river fully restored. River advocates say instead of reaching for an easy joke about the Cuyahoga, it might be a better idea to grab a paddle or a fishing rod. For NPR News, I'm Dan Bobkoff in Cleveland.
Archaeologists say they have unearthed the world's oldest musical instruments. The instruments are flutes made of vulture bone and mammoth tusks. They were found in caves in southwestern Germany. And they date back to the time when modern human beings who looked like us were first venturing into Europe. NPR's Richard Harris has our story.
Scientists have little doubt that music is so basic to human nature that it goes back to our earliest days as a species. It's hard not to make music when you think about it.
Clap your hands, tap your foot, dance, whistle, sing. There are any endless kinds of music you can make just with your body.
But Nicholas Kennard is an archaeologist, so he's looking for hard evidence of early music. He and his colleagues now report in Nature a spectacular discovery, four flutes buried in Ice Age garbage heaps in the caves of Germany. They date back 35,000 to 40,000 years, making them the oldest undisputed musical instruments. One of the flutes is made of a vulture wing bone, about 9 inches long. A replica sounds like this. Other flutes were made out of mammoth tusks. The early musicians clearly had leisure time, not only to play, but to make instruments.
Yeah, really quite a surprise that flutes would be made out of massive mammoth ivory, which is a material that's very hard to work, and not just bird bones, which are hollow and sort of ideal for making flutes.
Kennard at the University of Tübingen in Germany suspects the ivory flutes were favored because they produced a deeper, richer tone. He says archaeologists have found similar ivory flutes in more recent cave deposits and have figured out what it took to make them. First, a tube of ivory needs to be whittled from the larger tusk and then split in half.
Then you have to hollow it out, get the exact form, smooth out the inside and the outside, cut the ends to length, and perfectly cut the finger holes. And even if you can do all that, then you've got the problem of how to get the two halves together.
The ancient craftsmen cut delicate notches in order to get the halves to fit just so.
Then you have to seal it with birch pitch or some kind of sealant or glue, and then you can play it.
In order to figure out what one of those ancient flutes actually sounded like, a colleague of Kennard's made a replica out of vulture bone.
The first recording I heard was an absolutely horrendous version of the Star Spangled Banner that sounded something like a more awful version of Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock.
Alas, Kennard wouldn't share that recording with NPR. Instead, Kennard made available the more demure recording. Now, this ancient flute was found very close to another famous artifact Kennard recently unearthed from these caves, a carved figure of a female with exaggerated sexual characteristics, a Venus figurine.
It's certainly plausible that the people who carved and used the flute also carved and used the Venus figurine. Again, we can't say for sure, but they could easily go together.
What anthropologists can say without doubt is early modern humans who were venturing into Europe during the last ice age were expressing themselves artistically. Ian Tattersall at the American Museum of Natural History says, just think of the cave paintings from around this time.
We know that these early humans had the kind of creativity that we have, and now we know for sure that this creativity from the very earliest time included music.
Music and art reveal that human beings are using abstractions and symbols, hallmarks of humanity.
It gives us imagination. It gives us the ability to create new possibilities and new worlds.
Which is just what our ancestors needed as they pushed north, despite the hostile Ice Age conditions, 40,000 years ago. Richard Harris, NPR News.